we need reinforcements up here.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Thomas Massey. He is the United States Representative for Kentucky's 4th Congressional District. Since 2012, Congressman Massey, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Nick.
What I would like to do is to introduce our viewers to you via a couple of recent votes that you gave, and then we'll talk about what kind of binds us together. But you voted recently for the Keystone XL pipeline. How did you vote and why?
How did I vote? I voted for it, and I voted because I thought that the government was trying to hold up the project.
And that it makes total sense then to build that pipeline and to, bring Canadian oil through the country.
It does to me, and it's going to refineries in our country. I sit on the committee that, marked up the bill, and so I got a chance to hear the amendments that the Democrats offered. And they had some good points, but most of their amendments were designed to kill the bill. I wish they had offered amendments that were actually constructive. One of my concerns was the eminent domain aspect of it.
So how do you deal with that? Because a while ago, I made the mistake of saying, why not build a pipeline? And people were like, oh, come on, it's all eminent domain. So what do you do?
Well, this is where you discover that our founders weren't libertarians necessarily. At least they were pragmatic in the sense, because eminent domain is in the Constitution, so is intellectual property and some other things that perhaps libertarians don't always agree with. But my concern in the Keystone bill was to make sure that there was still a path for justice for people
whose property is being taken.
And there is.
Let's talk about CISPA.
Yeah, I voted against CISPA, and that was an easy no vote. So it stands for the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. And so what this bill does is it voids contract law between customers and their service providers. The service provider can no longer be held accountable to the customer if they violate the fundamental rights or even a contract by sharing their information with the government. Now, in exchange, the payoff to the businesses, the reason the business world and all their lobbyists were for this bill, is because it absolves them of any liability.
Are you worried in general about the government surveillance of everyday communications? And I mean, it's clear that the federal government and probably governments all over the world have the ability to basically snag virtually any communication that's happening. Do we need better laws in place to protect against abuses, and can we protect against abuses?
My background is technology. I went to MIT and got engineering degrees. And a lot of what I see Congress grapple with here is the introduction of new technology into society and trying to resolve that with the existing laws. I don't necessarily think we need new laws. We need to respect the Constitution. So just because we have a new type of technology like the internet, or drones, for instance, it doesn't mean that all of our constitutional rights have to go away. We, as congressmen, we have to be sure that they're preserved even with the advent of new technology.
Speaking of the internet sales tax, what's your position on that?
I am passionately against the internet sales tax. Now, they're euphemistically calling it the Marketplace Fairness Act.
But that's kind of like security and sharing, or protection and sharing.
Right.
Or the Patriot Act. We know it's the exact opposite.
It's doublespeak. Right? Yeah. It's Orwellian doublespeak. Yeah. And it's not about fairness. It's about lobbyists coming up here for big corporations and asking Congress to help pummel their competition using a tax. I mean, you have people arguing it's not a tax increase. Or they'll say that this tax is being raised, or it's not being raised. This is a tax that consumers already owed.
Right.
Because I guess...
And I mean, in the marketplace, essentially what the internet sales tax will do is it will authorize state and local governments to get payments from internet vendors in a way that most of us can avoid that, because if Amazon.com or Best Buy doesn't have a physical presence in a location, then you don't have to pay sales tax.
Right. The state of Kentucky could compel a vendor in New York to collect Kentucky sales tax. And I'm saying this is unprecedented. It changes the fabric of our country. It turns it into the virtual United States. The physical nexus was held to be the trigger by the Supreme Court for any kind of regulation or taxation.
Is there an argument to be made, though, that taxes should be collected at the place where the sale is made rather than where the consumer is? So let's say you're in Kentucky, you buy something from a company in New York. Should you be taxed at New York's state income tax rate to receive that in Kentucky?
Now, I contend the states can do that already. The states could tax the transaction. They choose not to tax that transaction because the companies will leave.
Right.
And part of this so-called Marketplace Fairness Act is about harmonizing tax laws so that companies can't and consumers can't escape one state's taxes by going to another state. And it takes away the competition that we have among the states, the healthy competition.
Let's talk a little bit about IRS oversight, because you're on the committee, the oversight committee that is conducting IRS hearings. What is your take on what's been going on in the IRS? And are the Republicans and the Democrats getting this right, or are they missing the bigger picture when they look at widely admitted abuses of IRS power?
Well, clearly laws were broken and abuses happened there at the Cincinnati office of the IRS, and it goes all the way to Washington. But Republicans and Democrats are missing the boat here. They've both adopted or internalized this premise that a 90,000 person bureaucracy that's 100 years old and in charge of enforcing 70,000 pages of tax code could actually operate without corruption or bias. The hearings, I was disappointed in the hearings. I sat through them and I asked my own questions. But the Republicans and the Democrats both seem to agree that if we just got the right people in the IRS, we could make the IRS work. I think we should be litigating not the administration and not necessarily the people who serve in the IRS, but the whole concept of an IRS and the big government.
So what would replace that then in terms of if you don't want an income tax or an IRS? How does the government collect tax revenue?
Well, if you had a flat tax, you could potentially have an IRS that's 1/100th of the size it is right now.
And that would be your preference, a flat tax?
Flat tax, like a 17% flat tax or a fair tax. The fair tax, which is actually a consumption tax, if you did away with the income tax, has advantages as well. Either of those would be preferable to what we have today.
Are you satisfied that the problems at the IRS were contained within the Cincinnati office or within a few bad actors in D.C. sending them? Or do we know what's going on yet?
We don't know fully. Of course, Lois Lerner took the fifth. It would be nice if we could get her to answer to some of the questions. The commissioner of the
IRS.
Although,
as a constitutionalist, you have to respect her right.
I respect her right, although yeah. I still have my own right to question whether she did the right things when she was there. The acting commissioner at the time of the IRS would not accept responsibility. I asked him, that was one of my questions, will you accept responsibility? He wouldn't accept responsibility for it.
Meaning that he did not give the orders to look at these groups more closely.
That's what he said. And he also said he didn't convey any of these issues to the White House, although the White House logs showed that he was there 118 times over the course of 2 years. So it's hard to believe there was.
I understand they have an incredible coffee shop in the White House.
Yeah, it must be really. He said he came for the Easter egg roll. but listen, again, we're kind of getting off the topic here. The problem is, it doesn't matter if it was that gentleman or Lois Lerner or who. It's the government is an organism. Big government is an organism that Congress has created, and it's its own defense mechanism kicking in. It's conceivable that people somewhere below the White House just decided on their own to attack small government organizations. This is big government going after small government proponents. That's just a natural tendency of this monster that we've created.
And you're arguing that, just at an organization that size, all kinds of weird stuff is going to happen, despite the best intentions. And we can't always rely on the best intentions. So describe your governing philosophy. I mean, what's the role of government in Thomas Massie's worldview?
Well, I can't articulate it any better than Bastiat did in The Law. But that's my description of what the role of government is. How one person treats another person doesn't change when you've got 1,000 people voting for one person who then treats those 1,000 people. The same basic principles apply. But Okay, so fundamentally, what should government be doing? And this goes to why I wanted to be on the Transportation Committee. My only experience in government prior to coming to Congress was as a county executive, and basically an administrator of the most granular local form of government you can imagine. And it's sort of a libertarian hell, because you have to provide all of these basic functions of government. But, you know, and we can argue about whether we should build another library, and I would argue we probably shouldn't. They're outdated, and it's not a function that government needs to provide. But very few people argue about the roads or the police protection that happens at the local level.
And as well as national defense.
Yeah, so that scales from at the local level. I found out even your most avid Tea Partiers wanted the roads paved and wanted the police to show up when something happened. Same thing at the state level, and here at the federal level, that applies to national defense and a transportation infrastructure where there is a federal nexus. So when I came to Congress, it's unavoidable we're spending money here. We're spending way more than I would like.
We're spending $3.6 trillion, you know, this year. What should we be spending next year?
We shouldn't spend any more than we bring in, which is...
$3 trillion,
yeah. Our deficit was about $1 trillion last year, thanks to the fiscal cliff deal, or no thanks to the fiscal cliff deal.
Which you voted against. And you voted against for a particular reason. What was it?
Well, there were several reasons I voted against the fiscal cliff deal. Not only did it raise taxes on to the tax brackets, it raised also the Social Security tax, but it also extended spending. It expanded spending on, for instance, unemployment insurance, and it perpetuated some of the inequities in the tax code, like green tax credits. It was just, I call it a really big turd sandwich without the bread.
Well, you know, everybody, nobody wants carbs anymore, so I guess that's it's paleo. This is paleo government.
Paleo.
You know, the government should be doing very few functions, essentially, and they're ones that where there's a clear kind of consensus that these things should be done. What are the things at the federal level that can be cut? I mean, you know, there are the big issues and the drivers of debt, like defense spending, Social Security, Medicare. But then there are other things like the federal role in education. You would want to see that completely destroyed.
Eliminate it. Department of Education, Department of Energy, we don't need either of the DOEs.
And what would happen? I mean, spin out a fantasy of, or an imagined world of, like, how would that make education better in America? Because, you know, Republicans, the Department of Education is not particularly old. It was, you know, created by Jimmy Carter. And it was Ronald Reagan said he was going to can it and didn't. He expanded it vastly. So Republicans and Democrats, you know, they're part of the problem here. How would education get better if we got rid of the federal Department of Education?
Well, it's in order to answer that, I have to tell you how it's been worse because of the federal Department of Education. The federal Department of Education, in exchange for some of the money that they dole out, has required standards or a standardization and compliance with rules at the federal government level. And I don't think our country is a one-size-fits-all country. And, you know, we have 50 different states that are all petri dishes for experiments in education. And we'd have more competition and less of a homogeneous education being promulgated by the government. So take that out of the equation, you have more competition and more flexibility. And just less bureaucracy. The money doesn't multiply when it goes from the states to the federal government and back to the states.
You know, you talk a lot, I mean, in terms of tax competition, in terms of petri dishes, you know, the idea of the states as laboratories of democracy. In terms of gay marriage, you are not, you don't think that should be a federal issue, marriage, but you are against the idea that states would have to recognize marriage equality. Is that correct?
I don't think a state like the state of Kentucky should have to be forced to recognize marriage arrangements in the state of Massachusetts. If Massachusetts decides to do this, I don't think the state of Kentucky should be forced.
And vice versa. So that's consistent, actually, with the idea of having a decentralist approach to governance.
I think so.
And the federal government really should be out of more, you know, it should be in very few things, because there are very few things that have to be dictated at the federal level.
And I don't think the federal government should be involved in marriage at all. And to the extent that they are through benefits or taxation, if we had the right tax code, it wouldn't matter.
Now, in terms of, let's talk about marijuana legalization, because you are in favor of an industrial hemp legislation. You've supported it for the state of Kentucky as well as a national bill, but you're against pot legalization for recreational use. Is it okay that, I mean, what should happen to states like Colorado and Washington that have legalized pot, you know, through plebiscite? Should the federal government step down and allow them to experiment, or should they enforce federal laws that would put people in jail for growing, selling, and using pot?
I think the federal government should respect the state's rulings on these things. And in fact, you know, my constituents in Kentucky are not for legalization of marijuana, and I don't expect that the state of Kentucky would legalize it.
Although it's a big pot growing state, right, by all accounts. Not that you would know.
I don't know what happens there. We grew tobacco on my farm. Yeah. Okay. But no, you know, the bill that I've sponsored here in the House, H.R. 525, it was a Ron Paul bill in the last Congress, would legalize industrial hemp. And it's a very simple bill. It's a one-pager. It just takes industrial hemp off the list of controlled substances.
What is the opposition to that? Because, you know, you don't have to be a kind of hippie, you know, wearing wallabies and a poncho to understand that industrial hemp is a totally different beast, that it has a you know, an endless number of uses and a long and storied history going back in the colonies, and including George Washington growing it. What's the opposition to industrial hemp?
And it was grown in Kentucky up until about 50 years ago in large numbers, so 50 or 60 years ago. The opposition, I think, is the lack of education about industrial hemp. When you tell people it's grown in Canada, it's grown in Europe, it's grown in every industrial country in the world except the United States, their ears perk up. And then when you tell them that we import it and you can go buy products in, you know, in the store right now, in the supermarkets, in Lowe's, that are made with this stuff, and we can't grow it here, they get more interested. And you know, it's, for me, it's more opportunity for farmers in Kentucky. It's an easy bill to sponsor for myself. It's just an educational campaign. And I think Ron Paul had 36 co-sponsors in the last Congress. 10 of those didn't return, so I had started out with 26. I've got 14 new co-sponsors. I'm up to 40 co-sponsors of the bill. And it's just a slow slog, you know, educational campaign.
Talk about Medicare and Social Security. I mean, these are, you know, old age entitlements, which are generally popular, certainly among the people who benefit from them. And they're problematic. You know, they are, you know, taking up huge amounts of money. They're unsustainable in their current form. What is, you know, what's your preferred option to replace them? And then, short of that, how do we reform them in a way that doesn't kind of throw people under the bus, but also doesn't bankrupt, you know, the next 10 generations of Americans?
Well, Social Security is not the open-ended promise that Medicare is. So you could actually fix Social Security if you had a few brave souls here to tweak things just a little bit. You could fix Social Security. It's a promise to give people money in exchange for the money they've been giving to the government. There is no trust fund up here. There's no lock box. I've looked around the lawn. I can't find anything buried up here. In fact, it was started that way as a transfer payment, and that's still what it is. But you could still make that work, conceivably.
Would you want it to keep working, or would you rather it be, you know, a kind of minimum income for seniors, say, or for poor people?
Well, for all the people that are relying on the program, I think you have to keep the commitment. But I'd like to see some way for the younger generation, let's say 40 and under, to invest in other things for the retirement.
Now, Medicare is a bigger problem because
it is
open-ended.
Medicare is an open-ended promise to provide health care. It's not a dollar amount. There's no limit to the promise. And as technologies come into play, you know, now you can have a hip replacement or stents put in or transplants, for instance. As all these new procedures come online, the question is, what are you entitled to in exchange for the money you've paid into Medicare.
Which covers at most, I mean, when you look at personal contributions plus co-pays and things, it's less than 50%, right, of the of the payment per beneficiary.
Well, and if you look at what the beneficiaries have paid into it, a couple, when by the time they go on to Medicare, has paid in about $110,000, and they can expect to receive $300,000 right. of benefits. That part of it's just not sustainable.
So how do we fix that?
I think Paul Ryan was on the right track. You have to introduce some free market forces. Unfortunately, that gets demagogued. This issue is very volatile, and people will come in and, you know the commercials, right. You've seen them. But you have to introduce some kind of market forces back into it.
Do you also need to means test in a more serious way? I mean, should people simply by dint of turning 65, you know, get an open-ended entitlement or even one that's constrained by market forces?
Well, when you talk about those things, yeah, you could go ahead and means test it. I mean, it's people need to be disabused of the notion that Social Security is a compulsory individual retirement account, that you've paid in some money and that the money you get back is directly proportional to it. It is not. In fact, Social Security is already progressively taxed. So it's, in a sense, it's sort of means tested as the money goes in. You could do more of that with Social Security, with Medicare if you wanted. One thing you don't benefit from much in Medicare that you do in Social Security. In Social Security, if you raise the age a couple years, you save that much money. But in Medicare, when you raise the age a couple of years, you really don't save much money because most of the healthcare dollars are provided toward the end of life.
Generally speaking, across the board, you want the government to be spending less money. You know, certainly no more than we're taking in, and you'd prefer to take in less than we take in. But you're also generally pro-defense. Talk about, you know, are we spending the right amount of money on defense? Are we spending too much? Are we spending too little?
I don't think we need to spend any more on defense than we are right now. It's almost twice of what we were spending 10 or 12 years ago, and we were fine 10 or 12 years ago. The question is, what's the right amount to spend on defense? And it depends on how many engagements you're involved in. Certainly, you don't want to get into a war or some kind of engagement and then underfund it, because then you're just putting lives unnecessarily at risk. But I would argue we should be less engaged in things overseas.
You mentioned earlier you're an MIT grad. You're an engineer by training. How does engineering fit into your worldview? And, you know, it's interesting. Do you define yourself as a libertarian?
I would say you could use any of these terms, constitutional conservative or libertarian-leaning Republican.
And people like Friedrich Hayek, the libertarian economist, he had a thing against what he called the engineering mentality. You know, that for him, engineers were these people who could plan vast, you know, complicated scenarios and tweak knobs and make everything work. Why are you, you don't have the engineering mentality that he was talking about, although you were trained as an engineer. How does being an engineer help you think about politics?
Well, there aren't many engineers in Congress, I'll tell you right off the bat. A lot of politicians get here by dint of intuition and feelings and ability to communicate, which is good. You need all of those things. But engineers rely on facts. I mean, we, for instance, I remember John Sununu came to MIT and gave a speech, and I don't remember anything about the speech other than this. He said, we need more engineers in Congress and fewer lawyers, because engineers are trained to collect facts and come up with a premise based on those facts. Lawyers are trained to take a premise and go collect the facts to prove that premise, regardless of whether the premise was true or not. So it's like the scientific method, and I don't see it applied very often here in Congress.
Well, and at MIT, you had in a macroeconomic class, you had a professor named Paul Krugman. This was back in 1991. What do you remember from Krugman's class?
Well, thank goodness I took a microeconomics class before I took his macroeconomics class, or I might have been scared away from economics forever. I loved my micro class. You could explain human behavior, coupons, why there's a first class ticket and a coach ticket on the same airplane, why they cost different amounts of money, why free trade is good. If this island has chips and this island has salsa, that both islands are going to be happier when they start trading. So microeconomics, it was like opening a new world to me, explaining human behavior with math. Then when I took Professor Krugman's course, it was more of a religion, and we were being asked to believe this. And he would say, well, we believe this here, but in Chicago, they believe this. And I thought, I didn't come to MIT to adopt somebody's belief system. I came here to use math to explain things. And I learned from it that there's a lot of witchcraft involved in macroeconomics, particularly the Keynesian view of the world.
You were a business owner. Talk a little bit about your entrepreneurial streak and how that informs your governing philosophy.
So when I was at MIT, I invented a few things, started a company, started it as a subchapter S corporation, tried to navigate the tax code right off the bat, and learned very early on that government wasn't necessarily there to help you. It was this thing you had to navigate in order to start your business or to keep your business going. Learned an appreciation for free trade again, because 60% of what we manufactured and sold.
And what were you manufacturing?
So I invented a three-dimensional touch interface. With my device, an artist or doctor could sit down and touch three-dimensional objects inside of the computer. And then in the case of the doctor, he could do a surgical simulation and learn a procedure without operating on a patient and feel what the procedure felt like. In the case of the artist, they could sculpt another toy or shoes or jewelry or a car dashboard and feel it while he was sculpting it. And it was very novel type stuff, and it goes straight to the 3D printer.
Yeah, why are you wasting your time in Congress? You're wasting everybody's time in Congress. You got to follow up on this. 3D printers, I mean, these, with the printing of a gun, oh my God, everybody is terrified. Do you see that as the next great leap forward in terms of human ingenuity and innovation?
I see 3D printing as the democratization of creation, kind of like the internet re-democratized commerce. You can go on eBay and sell something. You can start a company so easily and find a ready-made market. Well, this sort of democratizes the manufacturing process, and it makes it possible for you to design your own personal version of what you want and have it printed out immediately. I'm excited by it. When I was in business, it was the early 90s into 2000. The great thing about patents, and I know some libertarians are against patents, but the great thing about patents is they do spur innovation, and they spurred innovation in the 90s. But the good thing about patents is they expire. And back in the 90s, I was thinking, I can't wait until 17 years from now when all these 3D printer patents expire. There's going to be a revolution because we're going to have consumer 3D printers. And that's what you're starting to see right now. Those patents, those seminal patents are expiring.
But those patents are important because if people who are developing this stuff can't monopolize the profit stream or the revenue stream for a while, they won't bother.
Right, and it's in the Constitution. This is another example where I said the founding fathers may not have been libertarians because they put intellectual property in there as a pragmatic concession. They already knew that it would spur innovation. But the great thing about this country is the deal was, if you create it, you get to keep it, not your boss, not the government. You get to keep that.
For a period of time. But when it comes to copyright, though, you are not, I can't imagine that you're in favor of an open-ended copyright system, which seems to be what we have, that every time Mickey Mouse or some other, very influential icon or property of a company comes ready to go into the public domain, suddenly it's 75 years, it's 90 years, it's 100 years that the copyright stays in force for.
So Justin Amash and I were talking about this very example on the floor of the House today. And really, I think that's cronyism. That's not what the founding fathers intended. When the copyright expires, it should expire. It shouldn't be re-extended because you have lobbyists here in Washington, D.C., and you've got some kind of empire to protect. the founding fathers stated in the Constitution for limited periods of time for a reason, because that's the only real way that you spur creation and innovation. Now, there are some issues of other issues of copyright and patents that have been abused, much to the detriment of American consumers. And one of the bills that I've recently introduced with Zoe Lofgren as a co-sponsor from Silicon Valley is one that will fix part of the DMCA that...
The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is problematic across the board.
Yeah, well, part of that bill, when they passed it, makes it a crime for you to unlock your cell phone. Regardless of whether you have a contract with a carrier, it's still a crime to unlock your cell phone. And we're trying to fix that because I believe if you purchase a copy of something, you own that copy, whether it's a piece of hardware, whether it's a song, you can change the music if you want. You should be able to rewire the hardware if you want. But that copy is yours, and that's a fundamental property right. And I'm glad to see that Democrats agree with me on that.
Do you think there's a generational shift? I mean, you, as you are an insurgent within the Republican Party, you know, you crossed kind of swords with John Boehner early on in your tenure. You work a lot with people like Justin Amash and Rand Paul. Is there a generational shift going on that is also dispositional? I mean, you're much more libertarian than the typical Republican. You're also more tech savvy. You're more embedded in the world as it's happening, as opposed to, you know, maybe somebody like John McCain. Are there going to be more of you, regardless of what happens, or you know, how do you duplicate yourself?
We need reinforcements up here. Now, the good news that I got when I came to Congress is it's not just Justin Amash and me. There are at least half a dozen, possibly a dozen, depending on where you draw the line, of libertarian-leaning constitutional conservatives in Congress. We need more. The other bit of good news is that if you look at a vote like CISPA, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, you were two or three times more likely to vote against CISPA if you just got to Congress this cycle than if you'd been here for more than a congressional cycle.
What do you think explains that?
It's the generational shift that you asked about. I mean, some of these folks are younger. They understand the dangers of letting the government read your email.
Right.
And they're more in tune with their constituents who are, you know, of the same mind.
Talk a little bit about what turned you on to politics. You know, what were the events and the kind of trigger points for that? Because you were a county executive before you came to Congress, but you're not a... You didn't wake up at age 10 and say, wow, I want to be in Congress or anything like that. What brought you here?
No, it was age 40 before I decided I wanted anything to do with this place. You know, I always paid attention to what was going on in the world, even though I had a company to run and patents to develop and whatnot. But what I remember at MIT in 1993 when I was writing my undergraduate thesis, Waco happened, the event there in Texas, and it became obvious to me that maybe the government wasn't there to help those people. When the narrative was their children being abused and we're going to go in and help those children, and they brought tanks and guns and helicopters and started poking holes in the wall and firing CS gas, I'm like, maybe our government is a little too big. And so that was 20 years ago. And I remember watching that. That concerned me enough that I watched the hearings on C-SPAN. And I remember watching a congressman like Sonny Bono cry in the hearings. There were a few that fully grasped what went on there. And so I don't think you have to be a conspiracy theorist to realize that the government is sometimes out of control. Just look at the facts that are in front of you. So that shaped part of my concern over big government and the infringement on our civil liberties. The other was, you know, my experience in business and paying taxes, I guess, as a job creator.
And you've said that working against an occupational tax is kind of what helped you get into Kentucky politics.
Yeah, there were, before there was the Tea Party, this was in 2006 or 2007, I had sold my ownership in my company in New England, come back to Kentucky to raise my family on a farm.
And you live in a house that you built? You're off the grid? It's solar powered?
My house is solar powered. I tell Republicans, you can hate the subsidies. I hate the subsidies too. But you can't hate solar panels. These are rocks that make electricity. So they're incapable of receiving your hate. They are good things. Now, we shouldn't be subsidizing them. But yes, my house off the grid. I built it with wood from my own farm. I built my own ponds. I wanted to experience as much freedom as I could, so to speak. And you could find that there in Kentucky where I grew up, what I experienced as a kid. But what I realized was that our county government was starting to catch the same disease as the federal government, and they were becoming more intrusive. Under Bush, they were going to consolidate these conservation offices. Kentucky has 120 counties. They had 120 conservation offices. Well, our county got nervous and decided, our county government said, we need to make sure that consolidation happens here. We want the federal government in our county. Let's pass a new tax and build a brick building, a field of dreams for government, you know.
So they wanted to build it on the idea that the federal government would come to occupy this building paid for with a new tax.
Yeah, and I thought it was a really bad idea, so I wrote a letter to the editor. If I had taken that letter to the editor and thrown it in the trash, I would not be here in Congress today, I assure you. But instead, I took it to the newspaper and I published it, and we had 150 people show up at a meeting where nobody ever showed up before. We stopped this new tax, and it was just almost like a scene from a movie that day when we had 150 people show up and stop this tax. But I got progressively more involved. There was a zoning effort to zone all the agricultural land in our county, which is like 99% of our land, which to me is a taking. When somebody has the option of building a business on their farm, and you take that option away, you've taken something from them. So I opposed that, opposed a library tax and a few other things, and then decided it was probably easier just to run for office. And I was kind of the dog that chased the bus, but one day I caught the bus, and I was then holding the key to the courthouse, and it felt like breaking and entering the day that, you know, the first day of work as the county executive. But when I got in there, I found waste everywhere. Every bill that we paid, that our county government paid, had waste on it. The phone bills, we were paying for phone lines that weren't hooked up. We were paying for electric meters that didn't even belong to the county. Just everywhere you looked, every rock you turned over.
And you were popular and successful in cutting government waste.
Well, when I found the waste, I wanted everybody in the other counties to know there was probably money being wasted there. So I would go and speak in these other counties, the Tea Party groups or 912 groups or whoever wanted to listen to me. And that's when I developed sort of a small following there of people who understood that you could make a difference at the local level. You didn't have to be in state politics or in federal politics.
You are a big favorite of the Tea Party. You're one of the, you know, kind of the valedictorian almost of the most recent class of Tea Party candidates to win. Do you think the Tea Party strays from its most effective message when it gets off of the idea that we're spending too much? A lot of Tea Party groups seem very hostile to immigration, or they seem much more fixated on securing the border than reducing spending. How do you think that plays out, and how does it inform your views on immigration?
You know, when I watched the Republican Revolution in the 90s, which was kind of the first wave of the Tea Party, but they didn't have the name then, I tried to figure out who was for smaller government and who was for bigger government. I didn't care what the labels were, Democrat, Republican, Liberal, Conservative. Were you for smaller government or bigger government? And I think the Tea Party should stick to that. In my race, it was kind of the coalition of three groups, as I saw them. The Ron Paul Liberty folks, the Tea Party folks, and just Ronald Reagan conservatives who would have been part of the conservative revolution in the 90s. Just Republicans who don't ascribe to any labels, but are for smaller government. They know we're spending too much. I wish we would stick to that, because when we separate on social issues, we don't have the numbers here in Congress to pass the fiscal issues.
So what is immigration is, you know, front and center. You know, what do we need? Do we have an immigration problem? And if we do, what should we be addressing first?
Well, I think borders are important, and I think we should secure our border. I think we should take away the welfare incentive to come here. Most immigrants come here to work. In Kentucky, the legal temporary workers work on farms and provide important service in Kentucky. Otherwise, our food is probably going to come from China because we can't compete with that labor.
Should we have more temporary visas for agricultural workers or what is considered low-skilled immigrants? Would that help if the problem is illegal immigration, do we need to have more avenues for legal immigration?
I think we do. That's what the farmers in Kentucky tell me. There are some that comply with the law and some that break the law. And I've not spoke with the ones that break the law, but when I speak to the ones that comply with the law, they say, you know, when I try to do this legally, I open up my farm to three government agencies that can come here at any hour, any time, any day, and write me up on violations.
Do you think if we expand the possible pool of legal immigration, we actually help to secure the border because then more people will be streaming through authorized checkpoints?
I think we will. I think we do need a more streamlined worker visa program, not just for farm workers, by the way. We're going to be left in the dust on STEM issues. This stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. We let the students come here and we train them, but then we sort of kick them back out of the country. And these are some of your most entrepreneurial individuals that have ever crossed our borders. We would do well to keep them here.
You're a man of faith. Could you talk a little bit about your faith and how that informs your sense of government or your limits to government, why government maybe shouldn't be calling most of the shots at anybody's life?
I keep my personal views, or I try to, on religion separate from my public life here in Congress. It's important to me. My faith is important to me. I'll be home this Sunday with my family in church. And I think it's helpful in guiding my personal life, but I don't want to impose those views on anybody else here.
So in a way, that's also, I mean, a kind of laboratory of, a laboratory of democracy or of experiment, understanding that things that are personal and central to people's value systems should be, people should be able to experiment as much as they want, as long as they're not forcing other people into certain behaviors.
I think we should respect other people's religions, other people's views of the world, and try not to impose our own on them. I mean, and this is what government is about. Government is not about protecting us from ourselves. Government fundamentally is about providing some of these services you can't provide in the private sector, but also just protecting people from infringing on other people's rights or views.
Just a final comment. You've been in office now for a few months. Are you optimistic that your children will inherit an America that is more free and more prosperous than the one that you inherited or when you showed up here? I mean, are you fearful of the future, or are you optimistic that we will do well?
I am an optimist at heart. So I am optimistic that our country is going to go forward, but I don't think it's going to be because of anything we do here in Congress. I think that private industry and private individuals will succeed in spite of Congress's inability to get out of their way sometimes. But I'm also an optimist that we can make a change here, that we can have a difference. That's why I came here, and I'm ready to stick it out and fight the fight.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much, Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky's 4th Congressional District. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick.